Welcome to Normal for Norway.
I'm Indigo.
And I'm Seamus.
This is the podcast where each episode we dissect one weird thing about Norway.
So sit back, relax, and poison your in-laws with mushrooms. Allegedly.
Allegedly.
Yes.
All right, so today we're going to talk about foraging, hence poisoning.
Yeah.
As you were reading in the news earlier, apparently there's lots of mushrooms, lots of people out picking mushrooms, and...
lots of poisonings. Apparently 200 people every year in Norway get poisoned by mushrooms.
That's honestly a lot, actually. That's more than I would expect.
Like, lethally.
No. It's an epidemic.
Yeah, the unseen epidemic. No, it's probably just like mild discomfort or whatever. But it is much more than I expect.
Because yeah.
Yeah.
I'm actually surprised.
It's surely not that hard, is it? But this is probably people that are like a bit... risky or like a bit blasé, and they pick kind of weird ones and then don't do it properly. Or maybe they pick those ones that we've talked about that if you drink alcohol they poison you.
Yeah, watch out for them.
Yeah, what are they called?
Inky cap.
Yeah,
yeah. What are they
but
in Norwegian?
There's two types actually. There's one that's fine to eat even with alcohol, and then there's one that's not fine.
Oh.
And I don't know, because one grows in my garden and I don't know which it is. I need to check.
And you've never eaten it?
No, because
you could die.
I like checked
no,
what it was,
die,
and
but...
I looked it up online, and I was like, oh, it's this one, yeah. But you shouldn't eat it, because if you have alcohol within 2 weeks, then you can't have it.
Yeah.
But if you don't, it's fine.
Hmm. Well, first, before we get too carried away, the news.
Yes.
News.
First of all, Seamus is laughing because he sees...
I just started looking at... what is this picture?
Yeah, it's scary. So the headline is from... our dear favorite Avisa Oslo, obviously.
Uh-huh.
I'm still a paying customer. When will we get our sponsorship? I need to write to their advertising department.
Yeah, we really do.
I know. The headline, roughly translated, is this terrible smelling penis-shaped mushroom has shown up in Oslo. It smells like dead bodies.
Oh my.
Cadavers. And you can see from the photo.
It's not really penis-shaped.
It looks you know what, we'll let
it looks
our,
more like a straw.
We're gonna let our listeners be the judge of this, okay?
Yeah, so what's it called in English, do you know? Penis mushroom.
I actually don't know. Yeah, that's
oh, it's growing in the botanical garden.
Yeah, so it's funny, it's called Hagestanksopp. Smelly garden mushroom.
Garden stink.
Yeah. And I mean, there's not that much to say. Basically, it's just that it is an invasive species, which is bad. It's threatening like a similar one that does not smell as bad.
The local one is like, I used to be the only dick-shaped mushroom.
No, literally, though. Oh, wait, no, sorry. Okay. No, wait. No, that's actually the same one. That's before it turns red.
Okay, wait, I need to come closer. Hang on. Right. And wait, where is the native one?
I actually don't think there was a photo of the native one, but they mentioned that it's threatening a native one. And yeah, it's not poisonous. You can touch it. You can like not worry about it. I don't think you should eat it, but it's not like dangerous to touch, but
it's not like, or like, why is there news about it?
Because, well, it smells terrible. And so people were walking by the botanical garden being like, what is the smell of dead bodies? But also because it is an invasive species, and they think that it probably came in like soil that they were putting in the garden.
Ah, yeah.
And then, yeah, it's threatening the dvergstanksopp.
Wait, can you Google that? I want to see a picture.
It says it's orange and that it grows naturally.
Wait, maybe I've seen this one.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, no.
No?
It
looks scary.
Yeah, it looks very similar.
Oh, my God. Okay, sorry, that really looks like a penis.
Yeah, it's not nice looking.
No.
When I was out like foraging for mushrooms this year, I saw this really cool one that was like little orange fingers just poking out the dirt.
Ew.
And it's technically edible, just apparently doesn't taste like much, but apparently it's quite popular in like new Nordic cuisine, which we'll talk about later, as a garnish, because it looks very strange. It's like something that would grow under the sea.
Oh, freaky.
Yeah, I'll show it to you next time.
Okay.
We're out in the forest.
Cool. So that's the first piece of news. Second piece of news is very personal to me and quite sad.
Oh.
Because anyone who knows me knows that I love going to TaylorMade, which is
our
local, like, best donut. I mean, not even best. It's the place that brought donuts to Norway. Like, Taylor Brown, who runs TaylorMade.
Wait,
literally,
there weren't donuts here before?
Yeah, you wouldn't know this because you didn't live here. But no, I'm not kidding. There were not donuts in Norway. Norway literally didn't have donuts, okay?
Well, what about...
Smultringer?
No, no, they call it Berliner. Isn't that a donut?
Even that was like barely...
Like not with a hole, but like it's a...
Yeah. But even that was hard to find.
Rare, okay, yeah.
No, and I mean, really, she brought them to Norway. And so the thing is that she opened some shops, like, and several shops the last couple of years. Like, she really expanded. And now she's having to close.
Wait, why?
She's closing 5 of her 6 shops because just with all the inflation, like ever since last fall, people have not been spending very much on like luxury goods. And she said it's just been really hard. And yeah, I mean, everyone is seeing it. Like all the kind of...
Oh, we know.
Yeah, we do know.
Kazi lives.
Yeah, it's really a crisis. So
yeah, that's terrible.
I'm really sad.
But
so
which one is staying open? Our local
one. Our local one, thank God. Bispevika. So yeah, show some love for Taylor and get a donut or coffee.
We're keeping her in business, probably.
I probably am single-handedly. Like, I love it so much. I go there multiple times a week.
Yeah, that's a shame.
I'm really sad. So yeah, 2 food-related news items today.
Nice. I actually have some news also.
Oh my God.
Which is relevant to the topic this week about foraging, which is, well, foraging, anyway.
Kind of.
Yeah, or like we don't know, right? This is the mystery. So there's been a news story in Australia, in Victoria, one of the states, but like not in like, wait, which is the city that has, which city is in Victoria? Is it Melbourne?
I feel like if we say that and we're wrong, Angela's going to get really upset.
No, I think that's it. And then I think New South Wales is Sydney. This could be completely wrong. Anyway, Victoria, it's like a country in itself, you know, it's like massive. Anyway, this woman invited her ex-husband's parents over for lunch.
Oh, alone?
No.
With
also a pastor.
What?
And his wife. And...
That's a weird combination of people.
Yeah, so she's apparently on good terms with her hubby, her ex-hubby.
Okay.
And they were like all friends and they would go for walks together. And like the local community is like shocked at this like whole development. Anyway, after the lunch, like 3 of them died.
Okay, so who died?
So the two.
The parents.
Parents-in-law, uh-huh. Ex-parents-in-law.
Yeah.
Dead. The pastor is like still in hospital in Melbourne, which makes me think that Victoria is the state that Melbourne's in. And well, mysteriously, she's alive, not in hospital. But she said that.
And then the wife of the pastor is dead.
Dead.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, so this was kind of like a shock thing. It was like originally people were like, okay, well, it was probably a mistake because apparently in this part of Victoria, like foraging for mushrooms is popular.
Okay.
Yeah. And so that was kind of like, but people were like, but why did you not die?
Yeah.
Did you not eat lunch? And also her kids were at the lunch.
What?
And they were in the house.
Oh, okay. But they didn't have the lunch.
No. Oh. Or she said she served, it was a beef Wellington was the thing in question. She said that she served it to them later, but she scraped the mushrooms out. Because they don't like mushrooms.
Whoa.
Anyway, this was like the most recent update. And then, or no, like the first update. And then I just Googled it before we started to record this. And she has released a statement.
Whoa.
To try and clear her good name. Okay. Which says that she bought the mushrooms.
Yeah.
She said she bought some button mushrooms from a supermarket chain and dried ones from an Asian grocery store. And like, I'm now devastated to think that these mushrooms may have contributed to the illness suffered by my loved ones. Contributed? Like, they're dead. And everyone apparently, like, the symptoms were like mushroom poisoning.
Right. Contributed. Directly caused.
Yeah, I'm like, what are you talking about? And then she also says that she was also hospitalized with stomach pains and diarrhea and was put on a saline drip.
Oh, well, okay.
I mean, but could you reasonably poison yourself a tiny bit? So that it seems like, oh yeah, I also ate some. Like, she hasn't mentioned did she or did she not eat the Wellington.
Yeah.
But this is the real kind of damning evidence. She also confirmed media speculation that she took a food dehydrator to a dump, admitting that she had lied to investigators when she initially told them she had thrown it out a long time before. And she wrote that she had panicked and decided to remove the kitchen item after her ex-husband, the son of her dead in-laws, had asked her, is that what you use to poison them?
What?
Yeah.
Wait, so how would she... So she alleging, like, insinuating that she poisoned them...
By, like, maybe picking some poisonous mushrooms on purpose, dehydrating them so that they become even more, like, potently poisonous, and then, like, putting it into the meal, and then, yeah, killing
whoa,
them all.
Whoa.
I know, crazy. But, I mean, maybe it's all innocent. But I also do think, though, if you're innocent, would you secretly go to the dump and throw out your... Maybe, yeah, maybe you would just be in such a panic that you were gonna get like, no, I don't know, would you? I think honesty is the best
who
policy
knows
if you if you host a lunch where three people died honesty is the best policy. Don't go sneaking off to the dump to throw out your food dehydrator.
Right.
Yeah, three of the four guests are dead and one was in hospital in a critical condition. No, wait, so three of the hosts are dead. Yeah. So that's what's going on in Australia in relation to mushrooms.
Okay, so this, first of all, that's, yeah, a crazy story, and I really can't wait for, like,
me too,
the updates.
I want to
yeah.
know the truth.
Yeah, but also, I mean, to answer your, like, question of, you know, yeah, would you do that if you're innocent or whatever, it's like, God, I mean, what would any of us do? Like, I feel like you do irrational things when, like, crazy shit like that happens, you know? Like, I don't think she's necessarily...
The mushrooms in the shop, then it's just like you are completely innocent. Like, what else is there to say? It's like it's the shop's fault.
Yeah, of course.
So,
but it's also like, if she was trying to murder them, why would she have done such a bad job? Like, no,
well,
but what I mean is,
she,
like,
did murder.
Well, no. But what I mean is, like, it's so obvious then, like, or it's so criminal. Like, it looks so criminal to be like, yeah, only these people died. It's like, that would be weird if you were trying to murder
them. No, but maybe she's crazy.
Well, okay.
No, but I think, though, is there not something more behind that text of, is that what you use to poison them? Like, how does he know that she has a food dehydrator? How does he know?
Yeah.
Maybe, like, there's something
else. Did he
there.
Want them to get murdered? Is he in on it?
Oh, my God.
Sorry, we shouldn't even be saying this. What if he gets sued? Allegedly.
Yeah, no, I mean, we're just...
Where's
this
our lawyer?
Is conjecture.
We need a lawyer. Oh my gosh, I can't wait for the update. And also,
we're on mushrooms, a different kind.
Also, though, rest in peace to those people. I'm sorry.
I mean, that's horrendous. But also, like, if it is actually an innocent mistake, it's also horrific. I did hear her on the radio, and, like, she was crying and stuff,
oh,
and it sounded
God.
Very.
Ooh.
She did sound distraught. In fairness to her.
Oh my gosh. I mean, I have even more news, but I think I'll save it for next episode because I just remembered.
Yeah.
We have to move on. We've been talking for 10 minutes about. Mushrooms.
Yeah, well, yeah, it is the topic of the episode, but yeah.
Okay, so foraging is the topic, and what mm-hmm. what is foraging? Seamus, give us the definition in a nutshell.
Going out into nature and picking edible stuff.
Yeah,
I would say.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause, like, for example, cool. what we're drinking now
mm.
is a drink that I made. There are crab apples growing, like, in Oslo. Oslo's really good in general for having a lot of fruit trees, like, planted in public spaces that are available for anyone to pick. So you have, like, apples, pears, crab apples, cherries.
Yeah,
there's even, like, maps that you can go and, like, use to, like, find out all the places, and, like, people go, like, I've noticed all the apples in this little orchard that also has crab apples are, like, picked.
Yeah,
people are, like, want them. But I think it's also businesses.
Mm-hmm.
Like, little local cider breweries and stuff. Like, you know, the ZZ Pizza people.
Yeah.
They brew cider. I'm pretty sure they pick some of those apples. Anyway, I got these crab apples and I, like, did something to make the juice and da da da. But I'm like, is that foraging?
Yeah.
No, I don't really think it
urban
is because.
Foraging.
But it's. I think of foraging as wild food.
I mean.
Like, this is an orchard that's planted. I don't really see that as foraging.
Interesting. Okay, interesting.
Maybe a distinction? I don't know.
Distinction, yeah. Let's talk about a little bit about the, I guess, history, but also associations with it. Like,
yeah.
Is it good? Is it bad?
Yeah.
Is it?
Well, I feel like it's having a resurgence, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, okay, if we really go way back.
We were, yeah.
Let's go back to the year 3000 BC.
More.
30,000 probably.
Yeah, 30,000 BC.
Yeah.
People were foraging everything.
Hunters and gatherers. I did a lot of research for this episode, specifically about how indigenous people forage and what kind of foods forage in the present and also in the past.
Yeah, yeah.
And for me, I find this really interesting because I wrote my bachelor's thesis about mm-hmm. the Sami people in Norway and how yeah. they were like basically Norwegianified forcibly, like culturally yeah, aside. Yeah, yeah. And then my master's thesis was about some indigenous people in Washington who were affected by a nuclear plant.
Yeah, okay.
And food was really important to both of these. So for the Sami, food is like very important in terms of the way that they were, like I said, forcibly Norwegianized. And also, I mean, it's not just in Norway, it's Sweden, Russia, Finland.
Yeah.
Where they were forced to become people who were not nomadic. They had to stay in one place. They had to farm. They had to own property. Like, that was the only way that you could become integrated into
it. Didn't you even have to change your name and stuff?
Yeah, yeah. You had to speak Norwegian. Yeah, like, yeah. You had to do all these things in order to actually own property and be like a voting citizen.
Mm-hmm.
So, it, obviously, food, super important to that. And the food that most people would associate, like, kind of stereotypically with Sami people is reindeer.
Mm-hmm.
And it is true that reindeer and reindeer herding is very important to Sami culture.
Yes.
But there are also a lot of other foods that are, that you forage that are important.
Right.
So I was reading several articles about this that were super interesting. One, which I love the title of, was From Reindeer Stew to Pizza, the Displacement of Local Food Resources in Sapmi, Northernmost
sad.
Europe. Yeah, sad. And the author is Ludger Müller-Wille from 2000. And so he mentions berries, like cloudberries, which we'll talk mm-hmm. about, crowberries, blueberries, lingonberries. Oh, yeah. Supplying essential vitamins, and other plants like lichen, actually, and mushrooms. They would like boil them, fry them, dry them, smoke them, some raw consumption. And then he basically goes on to talk about how as they kind of were forced to settle down, then agriculture became more important, and then it kind of went back. And I mean, now in modern times, like I mentioned, there is some reindeer herding specifically, but
yeah.
in terms of like the actual gathering of foraging and gathering of foods now, I didn't find as much information about it, but I mean, I'm sure there's
in the Sami people,
yeah, but I'm still there. I'm sure there's still,
I mean, yeah, do you remember that film that we went to see, did you watch that film, Let the River
Live? I actually never
saw
it.
Oh, okay. Well, in that there's like a scene in the beginning where the girl is foraging with her granny.
Oh, cool.
Who's like fully Sami, and she's like singing this song, because in the movie they have this like, and maybe in this, like in, I don't know, this particular Sami culture, they all have like a specific song. So like when you're born, like someone that kind of like invents a little song for you. And she's kind of singing that. And then they're also like picking berries. But then the whole kind of story is like that girl's mom then, like not the granny, so like the middle generation, she basically like becomes Norwegian and like won't speak Sami anymore to the daughter. And da, da, da. But then this whole thing happened. Anyway, I won't ruin the story, but it's definitely worth a watch, that movie.
Yeah, I really need to see it. And then just very, very briefly touching on the other example I know something about, which, like I mentioned, was in Washington, and that was the Hanford nuclear plant, which was shouted out in Oppenheimer most recently.
Oh, was it?
Yeah. So Hanford was where the plutonium was developed for the nuclear bomb.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And so I wrote about Hanford for my master's. But what I wrote about was how it affected the tribes in that area.
Yeah, okay.
And one of the ways was actually with food, because a lot of, like, nuclear radiation was going into the ground, into the water, and all this stuff. And so, like, one of the ways that they were potentially affected, and it's a little bit hard to track, and there are all these scientific studies and stuff, but, and not just, of course, indigenous people, but also other local people. But one of the ways the indigenous people were affected was, again, with like food and plants and animals that they would grow
were poisoned.
Or eat there. Yeah. So for one example, this isn't so much foraging, but like the salmon, they would not just eat the salmon, but they would also boil the bones, and the bones probably had more radiation than just the meat. So indigenous people in the area were actually probably more affected by radiation than white or other people living there. And same with like plants that were growing and things like that. But one of the issues that the scientists had who were studying this later that they had an issue with was that they couldn't really figure out where the areas were, because a lot of those plants were actually sacred or medicinal to the tribes.
Right.
So they were very hesitant to actually reveal where they would be picking these things from, and so there
they
was like,
wouldn't tell them
because it was like a sacred thing, and so there were some issues with like actually being able to map how they would have been affected, and so there's been like a lot of trust issues, and that's what I wrote my master's about.
Oh, so what specifically the trust issues?
Yeah, communication and trust.
Oh yeah, because you did communications.
Yeah, well, kind of. I did history, but yeah.
That's crazy. But wait, also, what was the other thing that you were telling me about the oysters or like?
Oh, so that was this really good podcast, which I listened to a lot called The Sporkful, which is about food.
Wait, was that the same one that we listened to where we learned that the lobsters communicate through their bladder pissing?
Yeah.
Spraying.
Or no, sorry. That was a different podcast. That was a great one about lobsters. No, but so The Sporkful, there was an episode about these tribes on the California coast who are picking not mussels, what are they called? Oh, I'm totally blanking, but a shellfish off the coast, and it's illegal because it's like,
it's not oysters. No,
it's not oysters. Clams. Oh my gosh, I'm totally blanking.
It doesn't matter.
Yeah, it doesn't really matter, but I mean, it does matter, but you know, for our purposes, I guess I can pull it up here. But anyway, basically it's illegal because they had kind of gotten overpicked or overfished.
Yeah.
And then there are people now like picking them. Oh, sorry. I think it's abalone maybe.
Oh yeah,
but there are people who are like people from these tribes who are going and actually picking them illegally, but because for them it is their history and their culture. And it's like, oftentimes, again, there is some kind of spiritual or sacred meaning to it as well.
Yeah. And it's probably like you
yeah
came in here, stole all my fucking land.
Yeah.
Like forced me to do this and that. And now you're also telling me I can't have my abalone.
Yeah.
Like,
no, exactly.
Off,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah. So super interesting. I'm just really psyched and interested about this topic. So I feel like I'm going to go a little bit overboard. So we should probably move on slightly. In Norway specifically, or I guess actually in the Nordics, not just Norway, because Norway can't take all the credit. Foraging has really come back into fashion with new Nordic cuisine.
Yes.
So what do you know about new Nordic cuisine shows?
Minuscule portions, overpriced. Looks good, tastes like shit. No.
Oh my God. Hot take. You heard it here first. Wow, he said it all. Mic drop. Okay, so what this is fine dining using a lot of foraging, seasonal foods, local ingredients. It started in the early 2000s, very famous in terms of Noma.
Yeah,
which,
right, I was
gonna
say.
So Renee Redzepi, who is, or was, I guess is, because it hasn't closed yet, but is the head chef of Noma.
Yeah,
he basically founded this. But it wasn't just him. It was actually a movement by the Nordic countries. So apparently in 2004, he did kind of push for this personally, so he can take a lot of the credit. But in 2004, food professionals from the Nordic countries met in Copenhagen. I'm quoting wholesale from Wikipedia right now. Don't come at me. To talk about how to develop new Nordic cuisine.
And of course they met in Copenhagen.
Yeah, of course. And they actually met because they were like, we need to do this. Like, we need to push that for cultural reasons. Like, this is so important for
our countries. Our food tastes terrible.
No,
we need to trick people into thinking.
They were literally like, we need to rebrand you guys. Like, this is really bad. And so they were like, okay, it's going to be purity, simplicity, and freshness.
Ooh.
And seasonal foods.
Purity.
I know, it sounds like racial.
Cultish.
I don't like it. It sounds like...
Cultish. Yeah. It's like, but remember, that was kind of the same period that there was that whole vibe of like clean food.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think that's kind of been trashed now, subsequently.
Definitely,
Like, what the hell is clean food? What the hell is like, that implies that there's dirty food, like whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, so they met and it was Finland, Iceland, Norway, Sweden, and Denmark. And it was agricultural and food ministers. They all gave their support and they launched the new Nordic food program in 2006. This led to the funding of 3 million euros for related activities.
Whoa.
So I mean, they really were like, okay, maybe 3 million is not that much in the grand scheme of things, but like they
sounds
put
like
their
a lot,
they put money behind it. They were like, we want to do this, and it worked. And New Nordic has had a huge influence on internationally what it is to have fine dining. Like
it
has
that,
such an influence.
That other film, Menu.
Oh, The Menu.
That was
kind
of like, I feel like, modeled on this new Nordic, because weren't a lot of the things in it foraged?
Yes. Well, and so the thing is, I mean, the new Nordic has also really influenced dining around Seattle, where I'm from.
Yeah.
And the Menu is actually based specifically on a restaurant near Seattle that I've been to. And yes, it is very new Nordic. Like, it all fits. So again, the foraging went in a way mainstream, or I don't know if we can call it mainstream because it is still incredibly inaccessible fine dining.
Yeah.
But sort of mainstream.
But like, that's the interesting thing to me, because like, it seems like in the Nordics, foraging was always kind of a thing. Like, as in it now, I feel like in other places, it definitely like went out of fashion for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the Nordics, it kind of like stayed consistent. And obviously, it's now like had a resurgence again, maybe. But like, you know, it does seem like basically when, you know, when you talk to the older generations, they all grew up like foraging.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting in Norway that it's such a common thing, which we're going to get into. But what is also interesting is that I think part of the reason it's sort of coming back just internationally is that it has to do with like food security and insecurity. Like, there's something very appealing about being able to feed yourself. But yeah, I think it also can be in a way looked down on, like, oh, well, you have to feed yourself. You have to go into the woods and like find food.
Yeah. But that's then, kind of the old fashioned way of thinking about it. Right.
Yeah.
It's almost like we've gone so far. Like, we have like removed ourselves so from like to such a degree from like the actual production of our food.
Mm.
Like, as people who live in cities, like in 2023, that maybe it's part of like a broader movement of like, you know, people now are knitting their own clothes, like crocheting, like all of these crafts, and like making beer and sourdough and all this stuff is coming back because people are like, oh, I actually want to understand and like be closer to like how my food is made.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than just buy it in a shop, which maybe for a while was like the new thing and that was exciting,
right?
And then but like now it's sort of like, you know, the way things just go in cycles.
Yeah,
maybe like our like the next generation, our kids, if we have some, they will be like, ew, foraging. That's what my parents used to do. That's so cringe.
Yeah.
I mean, this like space food.
Ew. Yeah.
Imported
some like sludge.
From Mars.
Yeah. But I mean, I feel like this is all tied together in a really good quote from this article that I mentioned, the one titled From Reindeer Stew to Pizza.
Yeah.
Where in the end he says, Sami have fully realized the evolving process of dependence and globalization on its impending impact on local conditions, environmentally and culturally. Their position is clearly stated by Pekka Aikio, saying the rights to use the resources in one's own environment is closely tied to human rights, cultural self-determination, and governance. Food security, the access to local living resources through appropriate sustainable development, is one element of maintaining control over one's own destiny.
Ooh, deep.
So foraging is actually an act of rebellion.
Yeah, but I mean, do we want to talk a bit about why is it so popular in Norway now?
Yes.
And then finish off for this week?
So in Norway, how is it viewed?
I just think it's like, okay, so actually I was looking this up and it was like, there was this survey done in 2015 that was like, what percentage of people forage and so on. And they kind of did a press release. And in the press release, there was like all of these articles that they quoted that were like, you know, the berries are rotting out in the woods and like the apples are like rotting on the trees. And basically it was like this moral panic in the Norwegian media that mm-hmm. like we're losing touch with like our foraging culture. That was kind of like, you know, it's this typical like the decay of society. It was like typical kind of thing that we think is always happening. Anyway, CIFO, I don't know what organization that is. I think it's like some free love sleeve thing or something. They did like a survey and they were like, no, like 50% of people in the last year in Norway have been foraging. It was like super high numbers of people basically are still going out and foraging. So even though there's like this moral panic about it and like, oh, people aren't like bothered even picking the apples in their own trees anymore, it's like not true. And you can see it around Norway. Like, honestly, I don't know who, but like people come to those trees near us and they are rinsed.
Yeah.
For the apples. That's why we have to like have our crab apple. But I actually prefer the crab apples.
Yeah.
So like, I think it is still very, very common here. But like that quote that you were mentioning with the like guy saying like, oh, we all should have access to like the food resources basically in our local area, like in Ireland for example, we don't have that. Like Ireland is basically an enormous farm, or like there is so little wild land that you would actually be able to forage on because nothing is growing wild. Like we have hedgerows and we do have some woods and like people do forage, like particularly like blackberries, you can get like mushrooms and stuff, but in general, like, the country is covered in farmland,
right?
So we don't really have the opportunity to forage maybe as much as people do here. Like, as in, we can take a metro or a bus 20 minutes and we're in basically an enormous forest that is filled with berries, mushrooms, whatever. And I think also that's part of the reason, like, why in Norway it is so popular. Is that
it's accessible.
There's just so much, like, nature and wilderness where, like, things grow.
Yeah.
That you can pick and eat.
The blackberries thing we also have in Seattle. We have a lot of blackberries and they're actually invasive and they just grow everywhere and they're
where
super...
Where are they invasive from?
I don't actually know. Probably. No, but so they're everywhere and they're actually a problem. But people pick them and they're delicious. Like, I picked them all the time when I was a kid. I saw a really funny, like, parody article that was like, stupid woman buys a pint of blackberries at the grocery store. Basically, like... not being in the know, or like that you can just pick them.
I saw those when we were over, but they weren't yet ripe.
Yeah,
like in July last year.
Oh, they're so good.
Like brambles, right? Yeah, and they're kind of like grow on these.
But they grow everywhere. But yeah, I mean, Alex was just saying, your partner was just saying earlier that in England, if you forage, especially for like mushrooms, that's just weird.
Yeah,
he was saying, oh, it's like a hippie thing.
I think that was the thing I was thinking about, this like in the Irish context, which is like, I think in Ireland, basically, it was associated with poverty and it was associated, it had negative connotations because, like, of course, we had this colonial past and not in the same way of like kind of indigenous rights to forage. Like, I think we had stopped foraging by the time like the Brits came. Like, Ireland was already completely like agrarian or whatever. But like, there is also kind of, there was a negative connotation maybe with foraging. And I was reading like, this Irish chef, I can't remember his name, but he's brought out like a new book of like Irish cooking, and he's kind of like trying to go back to like when people were foraging. I suppose it's kind of like piggybacking on this like new Nordic trend of like getting back to nature and so on. But I think in Ireland it was sort of like, oh, why would you forage? Like, that's for if you're poor,
right?
And like, I think we had an especially maybe we were especially like triggered by that idea because of like the famine, and there was times when, you know, we were like displaced from the land or like, you know, forced to live off a crop that then completely failed and then we all were like starving and like, there's like crazy stories and shit about it. But I think there was like, and when I was also like reading about this in the context of like other kind of like natural ways of getting food, which were sort of stigmatized and like put to one side, especially in like the 50s and 60s, it kind of like peaked. So another example is like breastfeeding. People were like, this was kind of like a point in time when like faith in science was like at its peak, right? It was like, it was this new thing, we have a scientific like solution for everything. It was also like the same, right, around the same time as like this nuclear stuff. It's like,
yeah, science is going to save us.
Science is going to save us, but also maybe kill us. But also, so I think like people in like at that point in time were like turned their back on like, ew, I don't want to breastfeed. I don't want to pick berries. I want to like drive to the supermarket. I want to
buy my powder.
Buy my like powdered blackberries, my like powdered breast milk. And like, that's a sign that I am modern.
Yeah.
I have like moved beyond like my parents. It's the same thing with like, you know, probably that, those people in the 50s and 60s, like their parents probably would have relied on like sewing their own clothes, knitting their own clothes, and then all of a sudden you're like, oh wait, I can buy like factory made clothes.
Why would
like
I use so all that fabulous, time
so fantastic.
And then years later we're
now years later it's like, wait, I want to go and spend like 3 hours in the woods trying to find like four rotting mushrooms that then is going to poison all my family. Like, I want to spend
2 years knitting a pair of mittens for my friend.
Which are amazing, by the way. I spent like half a year knitting Alex a jumper and he hasn't worn it once.
Oh my God.
No, he's never worn it.
You knitted that jumper in record time.
No, I knitted the end and it had like a hole in the armpit, and I think like he didn't like that. Anyway, I fixed it recently. But
oh my gosh, he's so ungrateful.
But anyway.
Has he ever knitted you a jumper?
Sorry, so... the thing with Norway is, and this is a hot take, red flag, or like I'm flagging it now.
I'll put in like a siren there.
Is that, I think you could consider, for example, in general, the Nordics have been much more like equitable societies with less inequality in them, basically. So maybe that those societies developed without a stigma, as much of a stigma around being poor. And also, I think there's probably other aspects to the culture of like a deep connection with nature. You know, the Scandinavians love their nature.
They do.
Access to the land, like the Allemans record, which we're probably going to do a separate episode on, but basically means, or are we going to talk about it next?
We'll talk about it in the part two. We probably should do an entire episode on it at some point.
Yeah, yeah.
But next part two of foraging, we will discuss.
Yeah. But that you have access to the land. Yeah. Like you said, like in Ireland, even if there were berries growing on a farmer's land, you can't go in there and pick them. Mm-mm. Like he'd probably shoot you in the back, and in a court of law it would be like, well, you were picking his berry. You know what I mean? Whereas here it's like everybody has access to the land,
right?
And the final point on that is I can't remember.
In conclusion, Your Honor,
in conclusion, landscape is suited to foraging, culture is suited to foraging. Historically, maybe there wasn't the stigma associated because they didn't have the fucked up like colonial starvation past that we have. I mean, I know Norwegians will tell you like, oh, we were the like poorest people in Europe before we found oil, but we debunked that myth on the oil episode. Yeah. Actually, Norway was pretty wealthy even before the oil. It was just not as wealthy as the other Scandinavian countries, but like still much, much wealthier than like many other parts of Europe, wealthier than the UK, for example, in the 50s. Which would you ever think that the UK was a poor country? No,
I would now.
Well, maybe now, but like
that's... I feel like everything I hear about the UK is just like it's a flaming pile of garbage.
No, I mean, they've got the Spice Girls, don't they?
What year is it? Those mushrooms have gone to your head.
Oh my god, I wanted to think about whether or not cows get high on mushrooms, but let's talk about that next week.
All right. Bye.
Bye.